Welcome again to our series of programs on salvation history. The New Testament, the Acts of the Apostles, Epistles, and the Book of Revelations. This is Chuck Johnson, teacher at John Paul II Catholic High School in Terre Haute, Indiana. I'm filling in for Monsignor Moran for the remainder of this series. Our guest again is for our series is Ron Elred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High School. Ron, start by giving us a brief summary of where we are in this series.
When we closed the last session of this series, we were starting to discuss the Protestant and Catholic views on predestination. First, in this session, we'll look at the views of the 16th century reformers, Martin Luther and John Calvin, on the matter. As I said, we just had started that. Then we'll consider St. Paul's position on predestination, which is very hard to ascertain, which explains why both Catholics and Protestants can claim him as a source of their interpretation of the matter. After completing our discussion of St. Paul, we'll examine St. Augustine's theology on predestination, which is difficult to unravel because his views developed over time. So consequently, both Catholics and Protestants have claimed him for their own. Then we'll discuss the Catholic position on predestination.
Ron, since the doctrine of predestination has played such an important role in the history of Christianity, especially during and since the Protestant Reformation, let's begin our discussion of that subject.
Predestination, as we just had started to say in the last session, means a determining beforehand. The 16th century reformer John Calvin was the first to develop a complete theology of predestination. He believed that he was basing his theology on predestination on the theology of St. Paul, St. Augustine, Martin Luther, who was a generation before him, although their lives overlapped, and others. Calvinistic predestination is sometimes referred to as double predestination, which is the view that God chooses who goes to heaven and who goes to hell, and that his decision will infallibly come to pass. The difference between those chosen for heaven, that is, called the elect, and those chosen for hell, they're called the reprobate, is God's sovereign decision to show mercy to some by saving them and not others. It's called double predestination because it holds that God chooses both whom to save and whom to damn, as opposed to single predestination, which holds that though he chose whom to save, he did not choose whom to damn. One source has said God, for his glorification without any regard to original sin, has created some as vessels of mercy, others as vessels of wrath. Those created for hell, he has also predestined for sin. And whatever faith and righteousness they may exhibit are at most only apparent, since all graces and means of salvation are efficacious, which means effective, only in those predestined for heaven. I think that's a pretty ugly, pernicious way of looking at things. Calvinists believe that God's omnipotence, that is his all-powerfulness, that he's too powerful to share with humans his power. That somehow, if humans possess free wills and are given any role in their salvation, that this would somehow reduce the freedom of God's will and his omnipotence or powerfulness. Father John Hardin, whom we've quoted many, many times in this series and other series, calls the Calvinist brand of predestination predestinarianism, which denies that God has the will to save all mankind, since he wants only the elect to reach heaven. There's no place in this system for free or for true internal freedom of the human will, but only for external freedom from coercion. The eternal decree of God alone predestines to glory or damnation. The elect receive irresistible grace. We'll get to that later on, probably in the next session, that idea of irresistible grace. That's the I in tulip, meaning that they can't turn it down. The others have an impulse of the will to sin, and so are not given a salvific grace. The New Catholic Encyclopedia, I think this is a 2007 edition, if I recall right, says that John Calvin, who was a second-generation reformer, influenced by Luther and Zwingli, one of the leading reformers, who I believe he's lived in Switzerland, if I recall right, taught the first and absolute intention of God at creation was that certain men should be saved and the rest condemned to eternal damnation. This will of God is incapable of being frustrated. It imposes on secondary causes, even man himself, a direct internal necessity. Freedom of the creature consists in more immunity from extrinsic coaction. Only the elect are justified, that is, selected for heaven. Grace cannot be lost once it's been given to someone. That's, again, irresistible grace. The rest of men God precludes from the possibility of life, since he refuses them grace, without which they are internally incapable of positing a morally good act. In fact, God actually wills that they sin and die in the state of aversion from him. Again, I think that's a horrible, pernicious doctrine.
Well, especially when you contrast that doctrine with the way Jesus actually interacted with people. He always came to comfort, to convert them to faith, yes, but he always had an outreach to them. Think of the thief again on the cross, a criminal all his life, and the Savior took pity on him. So this way of thinking itself seems so alien to the Jesus that is so manifest in the Gospels. Now, how was Ron? How was Luther's view on this matter? They seem very close.
The New Catholic Encyclopedia claims that at first Luther accepted a Catholic view on the matter, which we'll get to later in the session. But after a thorough study of the Bible and St. Augustine, he gradually underwent a complete reversal of opinion and finally professed the doctrine of predestinarianism. That is, God both selects those for heaven and for hell. In fact, holding as severe a view of predestination as did Calvin, the Encyclopedia maintains that once Calvin finally formulated his view on the matter, he never really lessened his extreme view. He, like Calvin, came to believe that God chose some souls for election to heaven and others for damnation in hell. That is, like Calvin, he believed in double predestination or predestinarianism. To offer proof, Luther refers to St. Paul's biblical stories of God's election and rejection of Isaac and Ishmael, of Jacob and Esau, of David and Saul. The New Catholic Encyclopedia states that Luther dismissed all objections to predestination as he understood it because the contrary view came from human reason rather than the wisdom of God. I think we mentioned this in the last session that Luther and Calvin rejected the scholastic way of looking at things and of formulating Christian doctrines, which where reason did play a really big part. Moreover, Luther tied the doctrines of predestination and justification together, a subject we'll get to later. And from his study of the Psalms, Hebrews, Romans, and Galatians, Luther became convinced that the Catholic Church corrupted several of the central truths of Christianity, the most important of which was, as we have seen, the doctrine of justification, God's act of declaring a sinner righteous by faith alone through God's grace. The reason the Reformers believed in predestination was when Adam and Eve sinned, that is the original sin or the first sin, their human nature was so corrupted that it destroyed their free will. If humans have no freedom of the will or the freedom to choose or to reject God's grace, then God himself has to make the choice. It's a little more complicated issue than that, but that's, I think it pretty much in a nutshell. And in other words, again, if human beings have no free will, they're so corrupted because of the fall, then if they can't choose God or not choose God because the will is destroyed, then God himself has to make the decision from all eternity who he's going to save and who he's going to damn.
Well, Ron, what was Paul's position on predestination?
St. Paul's position on predestination and other matters is difficult to ascertain. As Luke Timothy Johnson has said, St. Paul is not easy to understand, which has led to much understanding of his letters, where his theology is to be found, of course, as we pointed out during this series, especially in his letters to the Romans and Galatians. St. Peter himself said that Paul was hard to understand, for he says in 2 Peter 3:15, 16, quote, "So also our beloved brother Paul wrote to you according to the wisdom given him, speaking of this as he does in all his letters. There are some things in them hard to understand, which the ignorant and unstable twist to their own destruction, as they do the other scriptures," end of quote. Lutherans and Calvinists, right on down even to today, claim that this is what the Catholic Church has done over the centuries, and this is what the Catholic Church has claimed Lutherans and Calvinists have done since the Reformation. Catholics and Lutherans have been trying to work out their differences on these matters and other subjects for the past 40 or 50 years or so, to, I think, with very mixed results.
It's curious what you're... how they interpret Paul. You know, the Gospels themselves are narratives, meditations on the Savior's life and the what he did. But when you look at Paul, all of his are letters. This is very important because they're directly addressed to specific Christian churches with their own assorted problems. So you cannot ignore the fact that he is a pastor, first of all. He is addressing his flock, and that means what he emphasizes in one context may be to offset a condition of sin within that context. For example, we know at Corinth there were a lot of sailors who were Christians. Sailors have some considerations most other people wouldn't have. On the other hand, you see the Philippians, very dear to Paul. And he addresses them in different ways. So I think that is the mistake that's going on here. They're not taking into consideration what Luke Johnson says is central, the contextual nature of the audience that Paul addresses.
Paul always had a lot of trouble with the Corinthians because it was a port city.
That's right.
Actually, it was a double port city. Because it was in the middle of an isthmus, and then there were actually two seas that didn't have a canal that connected the two, so they would have to pull boats that were going to go from one sea to the other across the land. But whatever, any seaport town has lots and lots of sailors in it, as you mentioned, and they were dens of iniquity,
yes.
All kinds of sins, brothels, and
nothing's changed.
So Paul always had a great deal of difficulty with keeping the Corinthians in line. In fact, later on, the fourth pope, Saint Clement, wrote a very, very famous letter to the Corinthians, telling them to straighten up and mind your priest and what have you.
There's certain constants in the human reality that we're seeing there. Okay, but let's back up and try to get a more general theology of Paul's predestination. Can we do that?
Somehow it is tied in with his theology of justification. Justification is a process where one is made right with God and brought back into God's family and made a friend with God. He writes in Romans 5 of sin and justification in terms of two men, Adam and Christ. Through Adam, sin came into the world, bringing death. Through Jesus, righteousness came into the world, bringing justification into life. This is a typology of the old Adam, who lost for us salvation by his disobedience, and the new Adam, Jesus Christ, who earned for us salvation by his obedience. We spent a lot of time on typology in one of our other series. In chapter 8, Paul connects justification with predestination and glorification. But it's my understanding that St. Paul doesn't promote the idea of predestinarianism or double predestination formulated by the Reformers, especially by Luther and Calvin. That is, the idea that God predestines some souls to heaven or glory and others to hell, but only predestines those to heavenly glory. The church has always taught that those who go to hell go there as a result of their own choices, and not because God predestined them to go there. Paul further states that those who are justified cannot be separated from the love of Christ. One scholar has said that several of these passages are central to the debate between Roman Catholics and the various streams of Protestantism, especially Lutherans and churches derived from Calvin. We're talking about the debates and the ecumenical meetings, you know, that they've been having over the last 40 years to try to resolve some of these doctrinal differences. Most Protestant denominations agree on some form of justification by faith, but differ on the meaning of justification itself. And much of the differences between Catholics and Protestants over the meaning of principal Christian doctrines regarding justification, sanctification, predestination, grace, salvation, and the church can be traced at least in part to different interpretations of these and other subjects in St. Paul's letters. These are all subjects that he dealt with in writing to the various churches and addressing, as you pointed out a while ago, the particular kinds of problems that they had, which made it very difficult to have what you would call a real systematic theology. It was theology, and he began to address a lot of the... he was the first to really begin to interpret the teachings of Jesus and to begin to gradually formulate them into doctrines, such, for example, the doctrine of original sin, justification, sanctification, and many of these other kinds of things. The idea of the church being the bride of Christ, that was another theme that St. Paul dealt with rather extensively.
You know, it's remarkable when we think of the scriptures, especially when Mary is addressed by the angel that she will be the mother of God. The eternal God bowed to the will of a woman, perhaps in her late teens. It shows the relationship, the offer of God's grace to us. Her response is, "Be it done unto me according to your word." So that humbling of God, which was the very essence of Jesus, for our salvation, hinged on the fiat of a young girl.
And of course you can see how even at the wedding at Cana, Christ gave in to her will when she wanted him to transform the water into wine, and he did, well, what does this have to do with me, and my time is not yet come, but he still did it. Yeah. So that's why we always stress so heavily her role as mediator, that anything that we ask Mary to ask Christ in heaven, that he'll grant it.
Yes. And in the rosary, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Let's turn now to Augustine. He's been acclaimed by both Catholics and Protestants. What can you tell us about his view on predestination?
Well, just as is true with St. Paul, St. Paul is difficult to interpret, and Augustine can be very difficult to interpret in some places as well. Some Lutheran scholars claim that St. Augustine taught double predestination, and that Luther simply followed him. They maintain that it was Luther's colleague, Philip Melanchthon, not Luther, who propagated the doctrine of single predestination, as reflected in the Book of Concord, which is a sort of a Lutheran profession of faith. And I think, for the most part, pretty much the view of Lutherans today, the idea of single predestination as opposed to double predestination. In other words, again, keep in mind, double predestination means that God selects those who are going to hell and those who are going to heaven, both. In single predestination, God selects those who are going to heaven, but hell, that's your own choice. And that pretty well is, I think, what the Lutheran view is right on down to the present day. I think this, as I said, I think this is essentially the Lutheran view. Lutheran scholars argue that Augustine clearly taught double predestination. Now, this is Lutheran scholar saying this. That, quote, from eternity God predestined those whom he would save and those whom he would not. Lutherans and Calvinists suggest that, according to Augustine, human beings are utterly depraved in nature, that humans are spoiled by the original sin, to the extent that the very presence of concupiscence is already a personal sin. In other words, they equate, Protestants do, what we call concupiscence, that is a desire to sin, sin looking glamorous and all that kind of thing to us, as sin in itself, rather than just a part of our fallen human nature due to the stain of original sin. Augustine's doctrine about the free will and its inability to respond to the will of God without divine grace is interpreted in terms of predestination. Grace is irresistible, as Protestants believe, results in conversion and leads to perseverance, meaning, of course, that a person remains faithful to their death. In other words, once you have been elected, once you, you've been chosen by God, of course, that took place from all eternity, and a person finds that out, you can't turn it down. It's irresistible grace. We'll get into that later on in another session. And at the same time, once you are elected, you will persevere till the end. There's no way that you can lose your salvation. Some believe that Luther, Calvin certainly taught that it's called final perseverance. In other words, once you get the irresistible grace, you're going to be saved. You're going to persevere to the end, no matter what. That's what Calvin thought. Luther, on the other hand, thought that, well, yeah, you could lose it because you could be wrong. And so if you lose faith, that was it. You see, faith alone. So we talked about it in the earlier session. Yes. If you lose faith, then that means you were probably wrong about yourself. So you aren't among the elect. And so, you know, you're not going to persevere to the end. In fact, you're probably among the damned or the reprobate. Well, the Calvinist view of Augustine's teachings rests on the assertion that God has foreordained from eternity those who will be saved. And the number of the elect is fixed. God has chosen the elect certainly and gratuitously, without any previous merit on the person's part. A Lutheran scholar has stated that, quote, in writing against the Pelagian heretics of his day, Augustine was prolific in his treatment of divine predestination. He taught that sovereignty of God was so great that even the hearts and wills of wicked men are directly controlled by God himself. In other words, no free will. Because of the absolutely corrupt nature of man, he had no freedom of the will. Therefore, God, in his absolute sovereignty, chose whom he would elect to glory in heaven and damnation in hell. That's a modern-day Lutheran, making that claim. He goes on to say that in the late medieval era, the scholastic theologians began to modify and deviate from Augustine's views on man's will and predestination.
I think it's very interesting if you look at the writings of Augustine, especially in the Confessions. Also, you can see it in Tractationism. But what you see is the grieving that comes up in Augustine because he says, too late have I loved thee. In other words, he recognized in his own being with remorse that it was his choice. Too late. And what had Monica been praying for all those years? For his conversion. So all the time he was with the Manichees, searching out this empty knowledge, he was inadvertently searching for his Savior and did not know it.
And his search, of course, was more philosophical. In the early stages, as he went through the Plotinus's Platonic way of looking at things, and then on to the Manichaean, and then finally Ambrose converted him to, the Christian way of looking at things.
And, of course, Ambrose himself was, like Augustine, a rhetorician of exquisite skill. Now, is there anything, though, any truth to the Lutheran claim at all?
This is difficult to ascertain. In other words, what you're saying, I think, is that is there any truth to...
Can we salvage anything?
Yeah, to the idea that Augustine, or as the Protestants sort of pronounce his name, yeah. Augustine, taught double predestination. Because this is what, you know, the Protestants are claiming. And this is difficult to ascertain because Augustine's views on various matters changed as he got older. And I think, but generally it's true. According to several sources, St. Augustine, quote, marks the beginning of a system of thought that denies free will with respect to salvation and affirms that salvation needs an initial input by God in the life of every person. While his early writings affirm that God's predestinating grace is granted on the basis of his foreknowledge of the human desire to pursue salvation, this changed, according to this source, after 396. Now, this is a Protestant source. His later position affirmed the necessity of God's granting grace in order for the desire for salvation to be awakened. End of quote. In other words, one needs God's help in the form of actual grace, also called prevenient grace, to believe in him in the first place. An idea that the Catholic Church had posited all along, and still today, right on down to today. This comes from Augustine. We can't have faith without God's grace, an actual grace. We can't do good works without God's grace. Well, then some people would say, well, if that's the case then, what happens to free will? If everything depends upon God's grace, you know, that moves us to do this, that, and the other, then where does free will come in? Well, I've always thought of it this way. Free will comes in for the fact that we can refuse God's grace. We can either accept God's grace, we can refuse to believe, that is, have faith, or we can refuse to do, you know, good works by refusing his grace. So that's where free will, I think, comes in. It's not, in other words, well, we'll get back to the subject at a later time. One source tells us that Augustine believed in predestination, but only in single predestination, which means that God actively chooses certain individuals to be recipients of his grace, confers it on them in a way that altogether overpowers their own will to sin and leaves them nearly or utterly transformed to live a life of blessedness. But God does not choose beforehand to send others to hell. And quoting St. Paul in 1 Timothy 2:4, that God wills that all men be saved, he says, even as we take actions that save only certain individuals, those who are damned by their own action. Nevertheless, for the most part, the Catholic Church considers Augustine's teaching to be consistent with free will, and that anyone can be saved if he or she wishes.
Thank you, Ron. We'll pick this up at the next session. God bless you all.